You're listening to In Search of the Sacred Bedrock, Christianity, Naturalism, Pantheism, and the Foundation for Human Rights by Steve Kim. Steve is Alberta Director of Apologetics Canada, serving in the Edmonton area. This breakout session was recorded at the Apologetics Canada Conference 2020 on March 7th at Northview Community Church in Abbotsford, British Columbia. For more resources, please visit us at apologeticscanada.com. Okay, it's 1:40, which means our second session is starting now. Okay, well, thank you for coming to this session. It's nice to have a full room here, so I'm not just talking to the air. By the way, this session is In Search of the Sacred Bedrock. So if you came to the wrong room, now is a very good time to leave. I won't judge you too much. But we're going to talk about human rights and their foundations. So what we're going to talk about is first look at what happens when there are no human rights, and then look at briefly the Declaration of Human Rights, just a tiny portion of it. And then we're going to talk about the different kinds of worldviews and whether they can make sense of human rights or provide proper foundation. Okay, if you've listened to our podcast and things like that, there will be probably some overlap, and hopefully it's not too boring for you. Hopefully it's a good review for you. Nanasane Chibutai. What the heck did he just say? I'm not speaking in tongues. This is a Mennonite church. I know my boundaries. Nanasane Chibutai, Unit 731. Has anybody heard of Unit 731? No? Okay. Anybody here from Japan? No? Good. Okay. when we talk about World War II, Nazi Germany is very prominent in our vocabulary, right? Because sort of they're the bad guys. Not all Germans, just Nazi Germany, right? But I'm from the East. I'm from Korea specifically, South Korea. South of the South, Southeast, where we have our own drawl, apparently. So when I talk in Korean, I apparently sound really hick. having said that, so when I think about World War II, Nazi Germany is pretty prominent, but also Imperial Japan is very prominent in my vocabulary of World War II. Unit 731 was a biochemical research center that was, it had all kinds of satellite facilities, but the one that's probably the most notorious one is this installation in Pingfang, which is near the city of Harbin in China today. So, just think Dr. Mengele from Nazi Germany, but worse. So this is an excerpt from Ueda Yutaro, who was a Japanese researcher with Unit 731, and this is what he says. To these guards at this installation, the people in here have already lost all rights. Their names have been exchanged for just a number written across the front of their shirts and the name Maruta. They are referred to only as Maruta number X. They are counted not as one person or two persons, but one log, two logs. That's what Maruta means. It means a log. We're not concerned with where they are from, how they came here. Now, this book goes on to describe some of the experiments that they carried out. Even with the intestines and organs exposed, a person does not die immediately. It is the same physical situation as ordinary surgery under anesthesia, in which person is operated on and restored. Witnesses at vivisections report that the victim usually lets out a horrible scream when the cut is made and that the voice stops soon after that. The researchers then conduct their examination. Of the organs, remove the ones that they want for study, then discard what is left of the body. Somewhere in the process, the victim dies through blood loss or removal of vital organs. And then this little segment, Pingfang was equipped for disposing of its consumed human lab materials with three large incinerators. Calling them crematoria would bestow undue dignity upon them. A former member who assisted in the burning commented, "The bodies always burnt up fast because all the organs were gone. The bodies were empty." So if you want to do some very light nighttime reading, look up Unit 731 on Wikipedia. There, you can also get a book named Unit 731 Testimonies. So, yeah, it's going to give you a really good kind of view of what happened there. It's absolutely horrific. Now, the 20th century has shown us really amply just what happens when human rights are taken away. Now, it wasn't an accident that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was produced, what year? 1948. 3 years after the Second World War. After this happened with Unit 731, after what happened with the Holocaust by Nazi Germany, and a host of other things. Okay. The timing, in other words, is anything but random. Now, if you look up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the preamble starts like this. Now, the preamble is sort of the justification for what is going to come after, right? So the Declaration of Human Rights lists all kinds of human rights, the right to mobility and right to, you know, security and all that kind of stuff. But the preamble gives its justification. This is why we're declaring these rights, right? This is how the preamble starts. Whereas, recognition of the inherent dignity and of the equal and inalienable rights of all members of the human family, all members of the human family, is the foundation of freedom, justice, and peace in the world. Now, did you hear those three words? Inherent dignity, equal rights, and inalienable. Did I spell that right? Yeah. Sorry, I had an ESL moment just there now. Inalienable. Okay, good. It's bizarre, right? Where are they coming up with this from? They never say. Not in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. They simply assume these things. Inherent dignity and equal and inalienable rights. So inherent, what does that mean? Inherent means that it's an essential part of you, right? You have it by virtue of being what you are. By being human, you have human rights, right? That's all you need to have human rights is being human. Being human gives you human rights. It's inherent dignity. You have worth. You have human dignity by being human. Equal rights. It just means that everyone has these rights to the same measure. If you're talking about rights, human rights between men and women, they have equal rights, or they should, right? Have equal rights. They should have these rights to the same measure, right? Disabled people should have equal human rights to people that are able-bodied, so on and so forth. Inalienable rights, what does that mean? Inalienable means exactly what it says. It's not the sort of thing that anyone can take away. Okay, you can suppress them, you can deny them, but you can't, and indeed must not, take the rights away. And again, when you do that, you get Unit 731. You do that, you get King Leopold II, who massacred some 10 million Congolese people, right? Which is, by the way, on par with the Holocaust, right? And you get things like the Holocaust, where Adolf Hitler, by the way, he actually legitimately believed that he was doing the service to humanity by cleaning the gene pool of humanity, right? By getting rid of the gypsies, the Jews, the homosexuals, the Jehovah's Witnesses, the disabled people, you name it. That's what happens when you take rights away. So the question is this: are human rights simply human conventions? In other words, do we just make them up for pragmatic reasons because it works for us? Or is it an objective feature of reality? In other words, is human rights the sort of thing that just people make up and people can just deny? Or is it the sort of thing that's actually built into our reality so that even if we deny them, they're still there? Now, most people would say, well, of course it's objective, right? We don't go around saying, okay, if, say, somewhere in Saudi Arabia, there's a gay person, okay? And these thugs just take him because they know he's gay, drag him to the top of this building and throw him off just because he's gay, right? Is that good or evil? Is that right or wrong? Does he have human rights, right? And people will say, yeah, of course he has human rights. It doesn't matter if some people in Saudi Arabia don't believe in the human rights of gay people. It doesn't matter. I'm saying some, not all, by the way. It's still wrong. He has human rights. So what that tells me is people believe that human rights are an objective part of reality. It's built into our reality. Now, what if it's just a convention, right? What if we just made it up? This would lead to what is known as cultural relativism. What that means is each culture gets to decide what's right or wrong, right? And these things are just all relative. Each culture is all relative. Nobody has that absolute objective rights. It's just all relative. Highly problematic. Why? Well, some reasons would go like this. If each culture gets to decide what's right or wrong, we can't look at Nazi Germany and tell them what you did is wrong, because they are just doing what that culture wants to do, right? We can't look at Imperial Japan during World War II and say what you did with Unit 731, that was wrong, right? That's just that culture doing what it's doing, right? And so that's highly problematic. You can't justifiably condemn any evil acts happening in other cultures, okay? So another problem with cultural relativism is this. If each culture gets to decide what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's evil, then social reformation is by definition evil. If somebody rises up and starts to challenge certain cultural institutions, that is by definition evil. So, Martin Luther King Jr., what did he fight? Yeah. Black rights? Yeah. He was fighting against institutional racism, right? So he was fighting for the equal rights for the black people. That's exactly right. What about William Wilberforce? He abolished slavery, right? He abolished slavery. Mother Teresa, right? She was fighting, right, for the destitute in the slums of Calcutta, right? These people, under this view, cultural relativism, they're by definition evil because they're challenging the culture. Ridiculous. And here's one more problem. There are lots of other problems, but this is another one. Who gets to be the voice of the culture? Because of culture is not a monolithic thing, right? It's made up of lots of different subcultures, different kinds of people, right? Think of high school. I was your typical band geek and ESL kid, right? In terms of like social popularity in high school, I'm at like the bottom of the rung, right? Like the bottom rung. Like I was lucky if I had a rung, right? What are some other types of stereotypical people in high school? Band geeks and
jocks.
Jocks, yep. And
cheerleaders,
yep. Sorry?
Nerds,
yep. Science nerds. There are different types of people, right? A culture is like that, right? Within the high school culture, there are different groups of people. Who gets to speak for the whole high school culture? That's the same thing with our culture too, right? You have different subcultures that all have different ideas. So I think it was Philip Johnson who commented that the United States is a lot like India being ruled by a group of Swedish elites, right? Indians are very religious. So what he's saying is you have this population that's generally very religious, right? But then they're being ruled by the secular elites, a small minority of people who get to call all the shots for the entire culture, right? But then who else gets to call the shots? Just the majority? Right? Just because the majority call the shots doesn't mean that the majority is right or good, right? Or anything like that. So there's all kinds of other problems with relativism in general and cultural relativism in particular. If each culture just gets to decide what's right, what's wrong, what if two cultures start colliding? Like in my country of birth, Korea. When Korea was forcibly annexed by Japan in 1910 and was under colonial rule until 1945, the end of World War II, right? Who gets to decide what's right, what's wrong? So that's why it's so problematic. So if human rights is the sort of thing that just cultures come up with, that people come up with, well, then there's nothing binding to somebody who says, I don't believe in human rights. That's a problem. So then it seems to me that human rights is something that's built into reality. That means we have to ask whether your worldview can support this idea of human rights. Are all worldviews equal in accounting for human rights? I say no. So we can all go home. No, please don't. Let me hash it out for you a little bit more and see what you think. So where do we go from here? One way to approach it is this. Let's think about human rights. Human rights is a moral category, right? When we're talking about human rights, we're talking about good and evil, right and wrong. We're talking about justice, right? These are all very moral terms. This is a moral category. In other words, in order for you to make sense of human rights, you need to be able to make sense of morality. If you can't make sense of morality, you can't make sense of human rights. So, I have a picture here for those of you listening in the recording. I have a picture of this, whatever this is. I'm not a very good artist. But we have a triangle at the top representing the roof, and I have three rectangles representing the pillars, and then I have one long rectangle lying on its side at the bottom serving as the foundation. So at the top, and right into the roof, I'm writing the word morality. In order for us to have morality, we need to fill in these pillars and the foundation. So what we need to have objective morality. Why do I emphasize this? Because I'm talking about the kind of morality that's valid and binding, whether you believe in it or not. If the Nazis had won World War II, brainwashed the entire world to think that the Holocaust was actually a good thing, it would still be the case that the Holocaust was evil and wrong. That's the kind of morality that I'm talking about here. Right? Something that the kind of morality that doesn't depend on human opinion. Okay? In order for us to have that kind of objective morality, what we need are two things for objectivity, and then I would throw in a third thing here to make it meaningful. And I can explain all of that later. First thing we need is objective moral value. This has to do with good and evil, okay? And then we need objective moral duty, which has to do with right and wrong. And then I would say we need moral accountability. An easier way to say it is justice. Okay? Did you notice something? Good and evil, right and wrong, are separate. Right? Now, we typically think because what is good is often what is the right thing to do, what is evil is often what is the wrong thing to do, we tend to think those two are the same thing. But that's not the case. So let me give you an example. Let's say I'm in Afghanistan and I'm fighting the insurgents with a buddy of mine. Okay? And as we're fighting, a grenade comes and lands right between the two of us. Okay? If I duck out of the way to preserve my life and left my friend to duck out of his way to save his own life, if I don't first save him, but I save myself first, did I do something wrong? No. I have the right to preserve myself. Now, what if when the grenade lands, I throw myself on the grenade? This actually happened. And this guy, after many months of surgery and years in physiotherapy, eventually got the Medal of Honor, which is the highest medal that you can earn as a military serviceman. And Barack Obama gave it to him, right? It actually happened. What if I threw myself on the grenade and it saved my friend's life at the expense of my life? Now, was that a good thing to do or an evil thing to do? Good thing to do. Thank you. Was I obligated to do it? Did I have to do it? No. So this is a case where the act was good, but I wasn't obligated. It wasn't necessarily the right thing to do. I wasn't obligated. So this is, I'll give you this fancy $50 word that philosophers throw around. This is called a supererogatory act. Supererogatory act. Just a fancy, intimidating phrase for this is an act that's above and beyond the call of duty. Right? So what we see is good and right are separate. They're related, but they're separate. Evil and wrong. Are there cases where you do something evil, but it's still not the wrong thing to do? Let's think of a case where... Let's get political for just a minute. Back in 2016, when the presidential election was happening down in the United States, poor guys had two very terrible options, or so people said, right? So you, on the one hand, you have Donald Trump. On the other hand, you have Hillary Clinton. And a lot of people are like, well, they're both terrible, but choose the lesser of the two evils, right? When you do that, was that wrong? I would even argue that that was the right thing to do. It wouldn't make sense for you to choose the greater of the two evils, right? But that's still evil. So this is a case where it wasn't necessarily wrong, but it was evil. See, another case of where moral value, good and evil, is separate from moral duty. Again, related, but separate. Okay? We won't worry about justice. If you want to hear more, if you search through our podcast, you might be able to find the talk I did. I think it's called Looking for Particle Knows What, right? And this is just, I titled it Naturalism Search for Morality or something like that, and you'll hear more on this. But notice that all of these depend on this one thing. Now, in the foundation, I'm writing the word personhood. So, value. Value depends on personhood. Did you notice that? So, a few years ago, I got together with a good buddy of mine, Eric Budding, for coffee. Maybe some of you know Eric. He's a philosophy geek like me. So we sit down and we talk about Plato, Aristotle, like we actually know them. But anyway, we started talking about value, and he pulled out his phone. It was an older phone, right? I think it was something like iPhone 5 or something like that. And he's like, okay, Steve, what was this worth when it first came out? And I said, well, without a contract, maybe like $1,000, I don't know. And then he said, okay, what is this worth now? And I'm like, I hope you're not trying to bargain with me. Trying to bargain with a Korean? Bad idea, right? So I'm just like, I push a hard bargain. I'll give you like $100. How about that, right? So he's laughing about it. And then he asked me, okay, so what's the difference? The phone didn't change. So why did the value change? Well, it's because of the person who's valuing it, right? And then he said, let's take it a step farther. Let's say we have this phone, but there's nobody in our universe. There's absolutely nobody. What is it worth? What is it worth now? Nothing, right? Because value requires valuer. Okay, so it depends on personhood. Duty, what is duty? Duty is something you owe, and you can only owe things to another person, right? this music stand doesn't owe me anything. I don't owe that chair anything, right? But if I were to borrow a book from Carmen, I owe it to give it back to her. Does that make sense? By the way, I just remembered your name. I'm so sorry. I totally recognize your face. We go back quite a few years. I was like, I know her. What's her name? What's her name? And then I remembered. Right? Okay. She's nodding her head, so my soul is redeemed. So you can only owe things to another person, right? Duty is not the sort of thing that I can owe to things or between two things to each other or anything like that. It requires persons. Justice, again, if you're going to praise somebody or blame somebody for the good or evil acts that they've done, you need access to the person, right? And it's something that the rewarding or the punishment is something that happens between persons. So you need personhood. So that's the foundation. You don't have personhood, you can't have morality. Now, what if we had personhood, but what if we took out value? Here's the problem. I'm assuming most of you here drove here, right? And for those of you who drove here, let me ask you a question. Which side of the road did you drive on? And please tell me the right side. Yeah? Oh, you guys are all laughing, so I'm assuming, right? Unless that laughter was an evil laughter. Right. If you're a law-abiding citizen in Canada, you probably drove on the right side of the road. All right. Now, is there anything intrinsically good or evil about driving on one side of the road but not the other? Yes?
You drive on the left side, you kill a bunch of people.
Right. Now, what's happening there is, let's say we didn't kill people. There's nobody on the road, and you're just driving on the other side of the road for the sake of driving it. Now, driving on this side of the road, that side of the road, is there anything good or evil about it in the first place? No. But what it does do is, what did you just do? You broke the law. Right? You broke your duty. Right? Now, if you were to go to Australia, what happens there? You better drive on the left side of the road, right? Now, so there's nothing intrinsically good or evil about driving on either side of the road. Now, causing an accident and killing somebody might be an evil thing to do, right? If it's your negligence or you're just flouting the law or something like that. But other than that, driving on this side of the road, that side of the road, it's not anything about good or evil, but it's about duty. If you drive on the left side of the road in Canada, that's wrong, right? If you drive on the left side of the road in the UK or Australia, that's the right thing to do. So this is a case where the value isn't there, but it's just a matter of duty, just a matter of command. Now, let's think about it this way. I know these are some grotesque examples, but I use this example because it's such a clear case of what is evil. Torturing a little baby for fun, okay? In a world where there's no moral value, what that means is this is neither good nor evil. There's no difference morally or in terms of good or evil between torturing a little baby for fun or caring and nurturing the little baby. There's no good or evil. And if you can't torture the little baby for fun, it's only because you're not allowed to, because you're duty-bound not to do that. That's crazy. That's crazy talk. If you are saying that there's nothing good or evil about torturing a little baby for fun, you need to get your head checked out, right? So that's crazy. What about if we were to take duty out? Okay, this is where it gets a little bit abstract, but stay with me here. Without duty, the word good and evil almost doesn't mean anything, right? So torturing a little baby for fun, loving and caring for the child, right? It's duty that makes me go one way, not the other, right? But if I don't have that, the difference between these two is basically the difference between A or B, red or blue, right? There's nothing that compels you to go one way as opposed to the other. So without duty, actually, good and evil almost becomes meaningless. Do you see that? You might have to sit with that one for a little while. It took me a little while to actually really grasp it with my head. So another example might be this. Let's say I'm playing an archery game and I have a red target and a blue target. The rule of the game is that I always have to hit the red target, no matter where it is. Okay. Now, what if I didn't have that rule? It doesn't matter which one I hit, right? So duty is like that rule. It compels me to do one act, not the other. And when I violate the rule, well, I actually violated the rule. I broke the duty. But without the rule, I don't break any rules by, I mean, if I feel like hitting the blue target once, I can do that, right? It's the same thing. Torturing a little baby for fun, loving and caring for a little child, right? If I feel like doing either one of them, I can. There's nothing stopping me from doing either of those things. So it's just the difference is red or blue, A or B. The difference is not right or wrong. You see how the good and evil almost becomes meaningless at that point, right? That's why we need moral value and moral duty if we're going to have morality. And we need personhood for that. See where I'm going with this? So then we have to look at, okay, can your worldview make sense of this? Can you make sense of personhood so that you can make sense of value, duty, justice, so you have objective and meaningful morality? Now, you might be thinking, but Steve, there are like over 4,000 different religions in the world. How are you going to go through all of them in whatever like 15 minutes that you have? I'm not going to. But if you look at all of the different worldviews and religions in the world, you can broadly group them into three categories. Okay? One type of worldviews says there is only the world. There's only the world, nothing else. This is your typical naturalists, right? Now, naturalism is actually really complicated. There are lots of different varieties. But what I mean by this is that kind of idea where this physical world is all there is. There's nothing else. No souls, no angels, no God. Just the physical world. Now, if you've been listening to our podcast, you might have heard Andy, myself, and Terry throw around the word physicalism. That's what I'm talking about. But physicalism is a very kind of a specific word, though. And this word is a lot more broadly used, so that's why I'm calling it naturalism. So just think, this world is all there is, okay? So in one type of worldview says there's only the world. Another type of worldview says there's only God. Okay, this would be your pantheists, pantheism. Pan means all, theos means God. So all is God, all together is God. It's not that you are God, I'm God, not like that. You put everything together, that is God. So we're all divine, right? We're all God in that sense, but we're not gods, but we're God. Does that make sense? Everything together is God. And then there are the type of worldviews that say there are God and the world. Okay, so that would be Judaism, Christianity, Islam, maybe Zoroastrianism, so on and so forth. Okay, so let's hash this out. Naturalism, the kind of worldview that says there's only the world. Can you make sense of this? I would say no, and for this reason. If this world is just made up of that physical stuff, take a brick, for example. You chop it down, chop it down, chop it down, chop it down, chop it down. You're eventually going to come to your subatomic particles, right? Your quarks and whatever the smallest bit is. That's all you have. Whatever the brick is just made up of these small things just piled together, and you have a brick. Does that make sense? But if this whole world is like that, guess what? You When we chop you down, 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 at the very bottom of your being, all you have are particles colliding, right? And you have more of that, more of that, more of that, more of that. That's what you are. Okay? Now, this is where this illustration comes in handy. I often use this illustration. You might have heard this before. Let's say there are two dominoes, okay? And we have two possible scenarios. Domino 1 falls, knocks domino B over. Or domino 2 falls, knocks domino 1 over. Okay, these are the two possible scenarios. Let me ask you a question at this point. Which one of these scenarios is evil? I see some smirks. I see some eye rolling, right? Why? Well, it sounds like a category error. What do you mean good or evil? Like, what's good or evil about blind physical processes, right? It's just dominoes doing what they do, given the laws of nature. That's all it is. There's nothing good or evil about dominoes moving. Now, what if we had 100 dominoes? Does it change anything? No, we just have more of the same. What if we had a billion dominoes? More of the same. What if we had 10 to the 80th power of dominoes? In other words, we have 1 and 80 zeros after it. Okay? Again, just more of the same, right? Now, why am I giving you this number? Scientists tell us that this is roughly, approximately, the number of elementary particles in our universe. That's how many bits we have, physical bits we have in our universe. So if this worldview is right, if all we have are just particles, then all we have are dominoes just cascading. How do you get good or evil out of that? See where I'm going? Right? So you can't have morality that way. What is a person in that view? Really, if the world is made of this one single thing called physical stuff, you're really no different than this music stand. Right? A pig is no different than this floor that I'm standing on, right? That light bulb is really no different than my daughter. See what I mean? They're all made of the same stuff. They're doing the same kinds of things, colliding with each other, right? Personhood just vanishes. You can't make sense of moral value because you can't get good and evil from cascading dominoes, remember? If there's no personhood, there's no duty. You don't owe anything to anyone. Justice goes out the window. Morality goes out the window. That means human rights, which, remember, is a moral category, right? Goes out the window. Morality goes out the window. Human rights go out the window. So naturalism, I don't think, in my opinion, can't give us human rights. So if you're, for example, the type of an atheist who believes that this world is all there is, but you believe human rights are real, you might have to rethink your worldview in some way. Pantheism, all is God. So some forms of Hinduism believes this. Some forms of Buddhism believes this. Taoism believes this, right? Or Taoists, I should say, Buddhists and Hinduists. Hindus. Again, it's the same thing as naturalism in the sense that they're saying everything is made up of a single kind of thing. This time it's God, not physical stuff, but it's God. And on pantheism, what they say is, for example, Buddha taught that everything is an illusion. Actually, they say the same thing in Hinduism. Everything is an illusion. And the Buddha taught that behind the veil of this illusion is nothing. In fact, Buddhism has this very particular doctrine called anatman, which is no soul or no self. So you actually don't exist. Okay? And the end game in Buddhism is for you to actually cease to exist as you escape the wheel of reincarnation and all that kind of stuff. It sounds very bizarre to people who believe in God and who believe in souls and things like that. But there's a reason they say that. I won't go into all of that right now, but everything is an illusion. This individuation, the idea that you are you and I am me, we're not one and the same, right? This idea of individuation is an illusion because we're all made up of the same thing. We're all divine because we're all together God. This illustration might give you a better idea. If you have a bucket of water and you have a drop of water and you put that drop into the bucket, what happens? The drop disappears, right? There's no more drop. It's part of the water. That's sort of the pantheistic view of ourselves, right? We're that drop. And when we go into the bucket of water of this reality, we lose ourselves and we become one with reality. It's very Star Wars-esque, the Force kind of a thing, right? In fact, Star Wars gets a lot of the Eastern mysticism into this. So if personhood is an illusion, guess what? You don't get moral value, moral duty. You can't get justice. Morality is out the window. Human rights go out the window. Whereas in this view that there's God and the world, and I would say particularly in the Judeo-Christian worldview, right, personhood is real. Individuation is real. So God creates human beings in his image. And so God endows people with value. Because he is unchanging, we have unchanging value. Does that make sense? Right? And so remember, value needs a valuer. In this case, we do have a valuer, and that is God. And he gives us our souls value, right? And so we can have personhood, and on this, we can build moral value. God's nature becomes the standard for what is good or evil. His commands, which come out of his nature, then constitute our duties, what's right or wrong. And then accordingly, we will be judged, right? Ultimately, justice will be done. So then we can make sense of this objective morality that makes sense of human rights. It makes sense of human rights because you are you, I am me. We're not one and the same thing, right? And it matters what I do to you. Why? Because you're made in the image of God and you have that inherent dignity, right? Because we're both made in the image of God, that means we have equal rights. And because God gave it to you, it's not mine to take away. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights sits actually very comfortably in the Judeo-Christian worldview. Now, the key thing is, if you look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, lots of different kinds of people came together to draft this. You'll find Chinese people, right, with some other worldview than Christianity, right? You will have your Muslims, and you'll have Christians and others as well. So they all came together to create this together. But if you actually look at the different kinds of worldviews that are represented there, I am convinced that Christianity seems to be able to make sense very comfortably of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, at least the preamble of it, and I don't think other worldviews can actually sustain this. Does that make sense? Okay, so we have just a few minutes. If you have questions, comments, concerns, threats, humorous anecdotes, now would be a good time to raise those. I know it's a bit like drinking from a fire hydrant, but yes.
With the Buddhist pantheism view, I don't know a lot about Buddhism, but I believe they have sort of a do good and
yeah.
Do, the karma. Maybe.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Where do they get that from if they have the pantheism view?
Yeah. So my dad and my grandparents actually used to be Buddhist, and I still have family members that are Buddhist in Korea, and I actually went to a Buddhist middle school. Just like you have MEI here, Christian middle school, and high school, I went to Buddhist middle school. That was fun. A Catholic boy going to Buddhist school. And yes, they talk about compassion, they talk about doing good things, but I find what ends up happening is it boils down to pragmatism. What I mean by that is this: if you wanted to get A, you have to do B, because that's how karma works. Karma is cause and effect. So if you want to do something that pays off your karma so that you can escape the wheel of reincarnation, then you have to do these things, right? Showing compassion and things like that. So it's really, it almost becomes mercenary, mm-hmm. right? Becomes pragmatic. You're doing this because you want to get this other thing. If you don't want to get B, you shouldn't do C, you know, that sort of thing, right? If you don't want to continue to be locked into this world in the wheel of reincarnation, then you better not kill things, because that's how you accrue bad karma, kind of thing. So Buddhists in generally are very hospitable people and things like that. But so I don't hold it necessarily against the Buddhists. But Buddhism, when you study it, I think boils ethics down to pragmatism ultimately. And that's my concern with it. Natalia?
Would you say that that's equivalent to saying that there's a duty there, but there isn't a value? So they have a duty because of karma
right.
to do these things.
Okay.
But it doesn't necessarily
Good.
Mean that there's a value.
Good. That's a great question. Does that mean then these pantheists, they have a duty because of pantheism, but. Well, actually, what I would say is no, because remember, what's duty? It's something you owe, and you can only owe something to a
person.
Is karma a person? No, it's a law of cause and effect, right? And that's why you actually don't have a duty in that kind of a worldview. And really, if you wanted to, if you don't mind getting bad karma, then really there's nothing stopping you from doing horrible things. Right? But in the kind of a worldview where God is present, he actually holds you accountable. You actually owe it to God and by extension to each other, right? Because that's how God arranged things. And then you can make sense of duty. So you can't owe things to karma. That's why Immanuel Kant, you know that German philosopher who came out with this, what he calls categorical imperative. What he meant by that was basically the silver rule, right? Do not do to others what you would not have them do to you, right? Was basically what categorical imperative boils down to. But again, notice, this is an axiom, not a person. And that's where even Immanuel Kant's categorical imperative falls short. In fact, he would say that categorical imperative only makes sense because God is there. Kant wasn't an atheist. Although a lot of atheists wants to kind of bring Kant to their own side, because Kant seems to say we can get to morality through our reasoning, right? But they forget that he actually wasn't an atheist himself, and he thought this all made sense because of God. But yeah, that's a good point. One more question, and then we'll dismiss you.
We recommend a book. I read Paul Champion's book that discusses all this, but it was it has a lot of like a story mm-hmm. to it. It was just a lot of reading to get to this. Do you have a book that you suggest that? Was
yeah. If you don't mind reading something that is not necessarily too comfortable to read, but it's not terribly complicated either, I would recommend Moral Choices by Scott Ray. Moral Choices by Scott Ray. Scott Ray, R-A-E, is his name. He teaches at Talbot School of Theology, which is the seminary of Biola University, where Andy and I went. He wrote a book called Moral Choices, and it's a very good introduction. He starts off with some of the broad views of ethics, like what's deontology, what's consequentialism, and all of that kind of stuff, what's virtue ethics. And then he goes over lots of different kinds of applied ethics. What about cloning? What about same-sex marriage? What about abortion, euthanasia? And what about economic issues and those kinds of things? So it's a good, really good introduction. He goes through some of the broad issues, and then he applies them to these applied ethics issues. Moral Choices by Scott Ray. Okay, well, thank you for coming here. I'm going to stick around if you want to come and chat with me further. But your next session will begin at 2:45, so feel free to make your exit and go to your final general session. Thank you.